This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 2nd, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Myanmar's longtime opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi wins a seat in parliament, but the hopes for reforms may meet reality in a country where the military still holds control. As violence continues in Syria, international delegates and opposition figures meet in Istanbul to push for action. And do you know who's looking at your cell phone data? A new report finds police routinely track cell phones without a warrant, and many people never find out. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. A Palestinian woman who fasted for more than 40 days in protest of her administrative detention in an Israeli jail arrived at a Gaza hospital today. Rami Al-Maghari was there.
After more than 6 weeks without food, Hanna Shalabi is now at the Al-Quds Hospital in Gaza City. She was deported from Israel yesterday, and as a condition of her release, she will remain in the Gaza Strip for 3 years. Shalabi could utter only a few words of welcome, as she is still too weak to speak. Dr. Nihad Abid is her physician.
She went without food for about 43 days, and therefore, what we'll do is start getting her digestive system back to normal in 2 or 3 days.
The Palestinian woman was part of last year's prisoner swap deal that freed 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in exchange of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. She was rearrested just 4 months later. About 300 Palestinians remain in administrative detention, held without a charge in Israeli jails. Some 30 of them continue hunger strikes. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
After months of electoral tension and violence, Senegal's new president was inaugurated today. Alpha Diallo reports.
The ceremony was held at the famous Meridian Hotel complex and was attended by close to 3,000 people, including 11 African heads of state. As his motorcade approached the hotel, the teeming crowd cheered Macky Macky. The 50-year-old Sall was given the oath by head of the country's constitutional council, and he promised to work in the interests of the citizens and uphold the constitution. He also promised to work in the interests of Africa. Today's ceremony follows 2 rounds of elections in the West African nation, which saw Sall emerge victorious in a runoff polls against outgoing President Ablai Ouad, the man he once served as Prime Minister. The runoff to the 4th round was marred by violence in which 6 people were killed, prompting the African Union, AU, and the West African Sub-Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, to send a special peace mediator, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Alpha Diallo in Dakar, Senegal.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that jail officials do not need reasonable suspicion to justify body cavity searches. The ruling means that even if an individual is detained on a minor offense, prison guards can conduct a strip search. In the dissent, Justice Stephen Breyer wrote, "Such a blanket search policy improperly subjects people held for things like traffic offenses to serious invasions of their personal privacy." In Nigeria, dozens of people burnt to death yesterday after trying to scoop up fuel from a crashed tanker truck. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
The explosion occurred Sunday evening at Ganikaku, a village where a majority of the people are peasant farmers. The incident is the latest in a series of disasters that occurred in Nigeria while the port scooped fuel from either leaking oil pipelines or crashed oil tankers. Even though Nigeria is Africa's largest crude oil exporter, official corruption has left most of the populace desperately poor. The poverty level is so high that many are not bothered about the risk involved in scooping fuel. Last fall, more than 100 died when a leaking pipeline caught fire. In 1998, more than 1,000 people burnt to death while scooping fuel. As the government removes subsidies, the price of fuel goes up. Those who can least afford it or who want to make money selling it are compelled to risk their lives scooping spilled gas whenever they have the chance. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
An acid attack in central Afghanistan has killed 2 children. Officials announced on Saturday that a 12-year-old girl and a 15-year-old boy were killed when acid was thrown on their faces and into their mouths. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack. and no one has claimed the children's bodies. Belgian police arrested almost 500 demonstrators yesterday as they tried to take over NATO headquarters in Brussels. The protest was against the International Alliance's military intervention in Libya and Afghanistan and its nuclear capabilities. Activists called NATO a threat to world peace. Rallies were held around the country over the weekend, continuing the call for further action in the Trayvon Martin killing. Thousands gathered in Sanford, Florida on Saturday, thousands more in Miami on Sunday. And in Indianapolis, more than a dozen protesters blocked traffic and were arrested as they protested the absence of an arrest in the Martin case. Attorneys for 21 activists in Bahrain convicted and sentenced by a special security court for their role in pro-democracy protests last year filed formal appeals today. One of them, Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, has been on a hunger strike for more than 50 days. Lawyers requested they be released on bail pending the appeal. The court refused. Another hearing will be held in April. Anti-government protests in Bahrain continue. One demonstrator died on Saturday. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Myanmar's pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has claimed a victory for her party, the National League for Democracy, at historic weekend by-elections, including a landslide vote in the parliamentary seat she was running for. While the unofficial results are already being celebrated by Suu Kyi's party and supporters in Myanmar, the Southeast Asian country also known as Burma, observers say challenges remain ahead for Suu Kyi and the party as it pushes for reform in government. FSRN's Ron Corbin reports.
Excited crowds outfitted in red and cheering for opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy flocked to hear her during the campaign for Myanmar's national parliament. Sunday's election for 45 seats marked a key step in the government's hopes for reintegration with the global community after more than 50 years of military rule. It was also the first time since 1990 that pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, or NLD, stood in national polls. In the aftermath of the 1990 landslide victory, the NLD was denied the chance of taking up the reins of power by the military. But this time, Suu Kyi hopes it will be different, telling supporters at NLD party headquarters Monday that the election could be the start of a new era, emphasizing a greater role for people in politics. In preliminary results, the NLD says it won by a landslide, taking 44 seats, including four in the capital, Naypyidaw. Khin Chaw Mint, a former political prisoner living in exile in Thailand, was overjoyed by the preliminary results.
NLD 44 seats won. Yeah. Like other people, I'm very happy. I think the NLD party and Aung San Suu Kyi working try hard. It's very worthy. But in my point of view, even though, you know, NLD won 44 seats, I think there will be many challenges in the parliament. They need to continue their work.
Suu Kyi has said she trusts the president and former general Thein Sein, who came to power last year. Thein Sein has overseen several reforms, including greater media freedom, the release of hundreds of political prisoners, and allowing the opposition NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi to campaign. But Debbie Stoddard, spokesperson for rights group The Alternative ASEAN Network, says concerns remain over possible interference in the final polling results.
There's always the matter of how whether the authorities will actually confirm these wins. So the longer we wait, the more we worry that the authorities might find some other reason to disregard the NLD's win.
If the elections are deemed to be free and fair, the United States and other Western countries could lift economic sanctions imposed for the military's past human rights abuses. Sean Turnell, an economics professor at Australia's Macquarie University, says the election is a test for the Myanmar government's pledge to reform.
I think this is really a moment when, the international community is really focusing upon to see whether these reforms are real, in the sense that, you know, that the regime or the government now is genuinely interested in pluralism and, you know, will really allow the voice of opposition, etc., in the parliament. So then I think what we're likely to see is quite a number of countries begin the process of lifting some sanctions.
Observers reported a high voter turnout in Sunday's by-election. Ang Zor, editor of the online news magazine The Irrawaddy, says people are excited about the results but cautious about the future.
And it was really inspiring because of people are so poor, they live in poverty. But they just came out and cheer and welcome with whatever way they can. It's so moving to see the people. And they're so hopeful, and it shows that they see Suu Kyi as the hope. And with Suu Kyi, they have no fear. But the problem is they don't know what is next.
Despite the potential victory for the National League for Democracy, the military-backed Union Solidarity and Development Party, USDP, and military representatives hold a commanding position in the more than 1,000-seat combined House Parliament. Xin Lin, also a former political prisoner, says challenges remain for the NLD, with Aung San Suu Kyi looking to cooperate with other pro-democracy parties.
That's why he said this is only the first step. The way ahead is very difficult. I think that she will try to make a democratic front in the parliament, and then also she will try to negotiate with the ruling party step by step to change the countries towards a fully democratic country.
Xin Lin says that after decades of military control, Suu Kyi and the NLD will face many challenges, including putting an end to the ongoing fighting between the military and armed ethnic communities. Human Rights Watch has accused the Myanmar military of torture, rape and murder in the northern Kachin state. In at least several areas here, the government did not let residents vote in Sunday's election. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok, Thailand.
Syrian activists report that 24 civilians were killed today as security forces entered villages and raided homes. Activists also reported clashes across the country, and the local coordination committee said 75 unidentified bodies were found in a home's hospital. This comes as International Envoy Kofi Annan told the UN Security Council that Syria's regime has agreed to stop firing on protesters and withdraw from population centers by April 10th as part of a ceasefire plan. But the Syrian government has broken pledges in the past in a conflict that the UN estimates has killed more than 9,000 people in little more than a year. Yesterday, diplomats from 83 nations, including the United States, met in Turkey to strongly condemn the violence and urge Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to go. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Istanbul.
It was the second meeting of the so-called Friends of Syria, a broad coalition of Western powers and Arab League members opposing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's crackdown on the uprising that's showing no signs of abating. Diplomats met with members from the opposition Syrian National Council, though comprised mainly of Syrian exiles. In recent days, it's been recognized by Western and Arab nations as the primary opposition group. So far, Western powers have resisted calls to directly arm the insurgent fighters. Instead, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton only spoke of non-military support to Syrian civilians.
We will be providing greater humanitarian relief to people in need, and we will support the opposition as it works toward an inclusive, democratic transition that preserves the integrity and institutions of the Syrian state.
Clinton told reporters that the group of 83 nations had agreed on additional sanctions on senior Syrian officials. She also said the U.S. would provide $12 million in communications equipment to help Syrian activists operating inside the country. Other leaders were more blunt. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said if veto-wielding China and Russia continue to block action at the Security Council, it would lend legitimacy to the armed struggle.
Güvenlik Konseyi If the Security Council fails again to take responsibility, then the Syrian people will have the right to defend themselves.
Nordon al-Abdo, an activist in the city of Idlib, has been filming inside Syria and posting video on YouTube. Footage he shot on Friday showed civilians, mostly women and children, fleeing artillery fire in the village of Deir Sonbul. Al-Abdul told FSRN the conference has little relevance to the people in his city while the daily attacks continue, but was confident that President Assad would eventually be driven from power. Al-Abdul also said Syrian officials have cut the phone lines and internet in many towns and cities. Some are using portable satellite internet to communicate. The Free Syrian Army has been asking for heavy weapons to defend communities against the Syrian military, but some world leaders are concerned these weapons would be used in a civil war between the country's religious, political, and ethnic groups. Hossan Ibrahim, a Berlin-based Syrian exile and member of the Syrian National Council, says many share these fears, but that absent real assistance, he predicts the violence will worsen and people will radicalize further.
The worst thing now is to just watch what's going and let more massacres to happen, and then you will find the mood change, as we've been seeing that now, and it will be changed to go more violently.
But so far, ministers appear unconvinced. In a communique transmitted Sunday, the 83-nation bloc called on the Syrian government to implement the Annan Peace Plan, which calls for daily ceasefires, a withdrawal of forces from urban areas, and the delivery of humanitarian aid. Assad signed the plan last week, but the violence has not slackened. Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu warned that if President Bashar al-Assad doesn't live up to his side of the agreement, pressure will increase and that all options remain on the table.
We will see what will be happening during these days, especially regarding the mission of Kofi Annan. And later we will look all alternatives to help Syrian people. I am saying all alternatives.
What action, if any, will be taken remains to be seen. Russia and China have twice vetoed UN Security Council resolutions and both boycotted Sunday's conference. Iran wasn't invited, and Clinton used the Syria meeting to criticize Tehran's nuclear program, driving it another potential wedge between the U.S. and diplomats here. A third conference is expected in coming weeks in Paris. Meanwhile, the fighting in Syria continues daily, with people continuing to flee the country. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Global extreme weather in the form of floods, droughts, and heat waves is set to get more severe and more frequent due to climate change, according to a report out by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. As the UN's Julie Walker reports, the panel's scientists are calling for action.
The world won't be able to escape the effects of extreme weather events, such as heat waves and deep freezes, unless action is taken to mitigate climate change. That's one of the main points from the special report on managing the risks of extreme events and disasters to advance climate change adaptation from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Thomas Stocker is the co-chair of the IPC Working Group, and he puts it this way.
The hottest day, which today occurs once every 20 years, is projected to occur once every second year by the end of the 21st century. This projection is based on the assumption of high emission scenarios, high increases of greenhouse gases.
The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says policies need to be put in place to deal with these disasters to reduce their impact. The report's authors say the main message it delivers is that the world knows enough to make good decisions about managing the risks of climate-related disasters, but it stresses that many times countries do not take advantage of that knowledge. Rajendra Pachuri is the chairman of the IPCC.
The world will have to adapt and mitigate if we want to deal with climate change, because that's the only way we might be able to deal with some of the impacts of climate change in the future.
The report notes that once thresholds or tipping points associated with social and or natural systems are exceeded, there is a limit to how far we can bounce back. Pachuri says this poses severe challenges for adaptation. Julie Walker, United Nations.
With the help of the foreclosure defense group Occupy Our Homes DC, Washington renter Dawn Butler obtained a stay of eviction today. Butler says her multi-year battle with J.P. Morgan Chase is an example of how tenants can fall victim to predatory foreclosure practices along with homeowners. FSRN's Alice Olstein has the details in Washington, D.C.
D.C. native Dawn Butler has been renting her Capitol Hill row house since 2006. When the owner of the house became ill and couldn't make his mortgage payments in 2009, the property went into foreclosure. Though several D.C. laws protect a tenant's right to remain in a foreclosed home, Butler says J.P. Morgan Chase did not respect these rights.
They tried to change the locks on the door. I was wondering, who is that in my house? I walked up and said, what are you doing? They said, oh, you, we're part of the bank and you no longer have possession of the home, so we changed the lock. I said, do you understand you're in D.C.? You can't just change the locks.
Washington, D.C. has some of the strongest renters' rights in the country, covering everything from adequate air conditioning to pest control to what's called the right of first refusal. That is, when the owner of a building decides to sell or faces foreclosure, the current tenant gets to make the first purchase offer. But Butler says her offer to buy the home was ignored for more than a year, at which point she got another eviction notice, which she's been battling in court for many months.
It's been very difficult for me to have my case heard. The judges don't even want to hear me speak. It's just that, you know, everything has been denied, denied, denied. So it gets to the point where, here it is, I call on Friday to find out, you're getting evicted at 9 a.m. in the morning.
U.S. Marshals came to Butler's home to evict her on Monday morning, but she had enlisted the help of Occupy Our Homes D.C., an offshoot of the Occupy movement that defends homeowners and renters facing unwarranted evictions.
They have been the most wonderful group of people that I have joined the movement now. So they are the reason why this stay is in place. All of this, they've made it possible.
While about 40 Occupy activists and supporters guarded Butler's home from the marshals and moving crew who had come to evict her, she went to court and received a stay of eviction. Mike Hack with Occupy Our Homes DC says these actions represent the best of the Occupy movement.
You know, what sparked Occupy was sort of this collective frustration with the banks and, you know, how they crashed our economy. And it's not some abstraction that the banks got bailed out and people got sold out, you know, like people are getting kicked out. And I think it is building a real spirit of solidarity. And we show, like, everyone we've worked with, every homeowner we've worked with, every tenant we've worked with, they want to be part of Occupy.
The group organized its first direct action in February for Maryland homeowner Bertina Jones. After a large protest outside the headquarters of Freddie Mac, the government-backed mortgage company agreed to negotiate with Jones and allowed her to stay in her house. On Monday, Jones called in sick to work so she could stand with the protesters defending Butler's home. Butler will present the merits of her case to the court on April 19th. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Police across the country routinely use cell phone information in investigations, but documents obtained by the American Civil Liberties Union show that many city and state law enforcement agencies track private cell phones without first getting a warrant. According to findings made public today, the information includes GPS location, phone numbers, and call logs. For more, we're joined by Catherine Crump, staff attorney for the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project. She joins us from New York. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
For this information, you enlisted ACLU chapters across the country. How many cities or locations did you get information for? And of those, how many are tracking cell phones?
This was a massive undertaking for the ACLU. 35 affiliates in 32 different states filed over 380 Public Records Act requests with law enforcement agencies, big and small, to uncover information about warrantless cell phone tracking. And we got responses from about 200 of those agencies. And what this revealed was that cell phone tracking is now a routine law enforcement practice, that essentially all law enforcement agencies engage in it. And our request showed that of the 205 law enforcement agencies that responded to our request, only 10 affirmatively stated that they did not track cell phones.
Well, to get into some of those findings, as you say, some 200 law enforcement agencies saying that they do use some kind of tracking of cell phones in investigations. It seems that the police obtain different kinds of information. For example, in Lincoln, Nebraska, police obtain GPS information from cell phones. In Tucson, Arizona, authorities accessed all cell phones for a certain location. What kinds of information are authorities getting from people's cell phones?
There is a huge range, as you mentioned, and there's really no uniform standards across the country. So cell phones can be tracked in a variety of ways. They can be tracked by figuring out what cell phone towers a phone is communicating with. And by the way, you don't have to have a fancy cell phone for that to be true. Even an ordinary cell phone registers its location several times a minute with the cell phone company. So some police officers track cell phones by figuring out what towers they're communicating with. Others track them in an even more precise way by, for example, figuring out where they are using precise GPS coordinates. And also, in some cases, law enforcement agencies submit very broad requests for tracking information. So, for example, they have a phone that they're interested in, a target phone, and they not only track that phone, but they also get authorization to track, using precise GPS, every phone that called that particular phone, which means that if a suspected criminal, for instance, called a pizza delivery guy, that delivery guy ends up getting tracked too. So it's a very broad net that police officers are sometimes casting.
And how do authorities obtain this information? Do telecom companies comply or enable this? What is their role?
You know, I think that's actually one of the biggest problems here. We think law enforcement should have to get a warrant based on probable cause to track cell phones. It's a very invasive practice. Knowing where someone goes can reveal a great deal about them. But unfortunately, these records definitively show that many law enforcement agents don't get that. Some of them get cell phone location information from companies merely by using a subpoena and without any court involvement whatsoever. Others do go to court, but they only show that the information they're seeking is relevant to an ongoing investigation, which is a far lower standard than probable cause. You know, if the cell phone companies have a role to play here, there's not much they can do if they get a court order requiring them to turn over information. But they've fallen down on the job of informing their customers about, you know, how incredibly frequent cell tracking requests are. And the circumstances under which law enforcement agents are engaging in tracking.
Well, going back to that example you gave about the pizza delivery person who may have not the prime suspect or the prime person in investigation, but was connected in some way. Would that person even know that their cell phone had been compromised or their information had been taken?
No, most people whose cell phones are tracked never learn about that. You know, if your cell phone is tracked and the police decide that you didn't do anything wrong, you'll never hear about it. The only circumstance in which this tends to come to light is if someone is actually prosecuted for a crime and then the police use that evidence in their trial.
Well, as you note, some of these cities did require a warrant before tracking cell phones. For example, North Las Vegas and Wichita, Kansas. Did they give a reason why the police in these places were different than other places?
No, they didn't give a reason. And in general, the responses we got were fairly terse. But it's nonetheless heartening to see that they are satisfying those requirements. And it makes it seem clear that you don't have to choose between protecting people's privacy and, you know, advancing criminal investigations. We could have both, and that's what we ought to have.
Catherine Crump is staff attorney for the ACLU. She joined us to talk about the police's use of cell phone tracking in investigations. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carrizley. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.